Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Mananjali, Yugambeh, Kombamiri, Noonuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world via the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, thank you to Karen Durante for hosting the program yesterday. Kado Muir from over in the West joined us again. And it had to be a good show. Kado is certainly a great talent, a knowledgeable man, and quite articulate. So it was great to have Kado back after our short time on the show with him on Monday. Well, what a great day. Blue sky, sunshine, what more could you ask? Full fridge and a roof over my head. I'm like the basics, and that's about it. Today, I have Josie Crawshaw joining me. Josie's all the way from Darwin. Josie, tell us your mob, your country.
Oh, good morning, Tiger. And I'd also like to first pay my respects to the traditional owners on which the station is actually built, and all of the extended traditional owners of where this this story will go out to. I'm from Darwin, but my mother was part of the Stolen Generation and removed from Gurindji country, a station called Imbunya Station. People will know it as the area of Dugaragu, where the walk-off happened in 1966 and the start of some of the real land rights reform at a much bigger level, where, of course, there were many other struggles for land rights right from the beginning. But this is where they started to actually put it into full legislation. I'm, as I said, brought up in Darwin, and Tiger and I go back a lot of years from the 80s and early, late 70s and 80s and 90s in the struggle for our rights.
Sure do. We Josie, and it's great to have you in the studio, I tell you. I was quite surprised to hear that you were in town. When I heard that news, I insisted that you come and do a show with us if you had the time. So I'm really grateful that you're able to fit the time in. Yeah. This program goes out across our National Indigenous Radio Service network, as you probably know, into a lot of the communities throughout Central Desert, Kimberley, Cape York, around. And it's a great opportunity for our mob to hear from people like yourself just what's happening on the ground. Tell us a bit about where you grew up.
Well, as I said, I was born in Darwin, I had quite some years here in Queensland, but around, you know, Charters Towers, Eyre, Home Hill, Townsville. As you know, I mean, I was born in the 50s, so you can do your numbers yourself about how old I am. But, and we were under those laws of those days where our Aboriginal mothers didn't have rights, and so the courts awarded custody to our father, and we were brought across here to Queensland. And we ended up, my two sisters and I, most times then being wards of the state based in Townsville with different families, until my mother was able to get us back. And it took her about 3 or 4 years to bring us back to the territory. And she had the help of some really well-established figures there. There was a people might know about the Paspaley Pearls. Well, the brother of that family, he was the original millionaire, and my mum looked after him. She was the first Aboriginal health worker in the territory, and she looked after him when he first came out to Australia. And he always said to her that he owed her, and when she, you know, she was just a worker at the hospital, didn't have much money, and she said, if you can help me bring my children back to the territory, I will, and that was in 1958, I will repay you, and which is how that happened, and we got back to Darwin. So from then on, I did my schooling up until probably the second year of high school, and then I came back to Charters Towers and went to St. Gabriel's Boarding School, And that's where I met a lot of the Aboriginal people from Queensland here, like Lizzie Geyer and Iris Palmer, and a lot of the TI people. And so we were there in 1967, you know, when Aboriginal people for the first time were getting their rights recognised. And I can remember being at boarding school and thinking how much we weren't part of that whole development. But I was about 17. But we certainly got brought up in an era where we were made to feel very, very different. And if we excelled, it was always promoting the school of, you know, how proud they were that we were sort of becoming, I guess, and developing skills like non-Aboriginal people. And we were sort of, you know, walked out in the forum. And I guess for them, they would have thought it was a great honour and respect to us. And in one way it was, but it was the way it was promoted of how surprised that they were that we were now, you know, starting to be good, upstanding young students and citizens.
Tell us a bit more about your pathway through to your position now, which we'll go into, but your pathway through there. You started out in Queensland, you went back over to the Northern Territory. Did you get any time at all on home country, Dagaragu?
I always go home for the actual walk-off. They still celebrate that. And but I guess if I just step back one bit, as I said, my mum was taken in 1923 and her brother, Jack Cusack, was taken to the centre. And my mum was about 50 by the time she met him again. And so we've got a big extended family that are both from Uncle Jack's side that are up, half of them in Darwin, half of them in the centre, some in Yuendamu. And then my mother had they had the same mother, but they had a traditional father. So my uncles were stayed at Duggaruga, where they walked off the cattle stations. They were stockmen. They walked off, and that's where they camped in Waddy Creek. Mum got to see my uncles in the sort of late 70s. And met her two brothers, and we lost my last uncle in 2006. People might have heard about that story where there was the big celebration of the walk-off, 40 years, and my uncle was 78 and was taken very sick just about 10 days prior to that into Catherine Hospital. And he didn't have much English. He was 78% blind. At the time, I worked in the Aboriginal Interpreter Service, and we provide a free service to the Catherine Hospital. At no stage was an interpreter given to him to understand his proceedings in the hospital. He was then airlifted back out to Kalkarindi, where all the airstrips in between Duggaruga and Kalkarindi, and tragically he was refused an escort, and he met all the criteria of an elder to have an escort come with him. If he would have had an escort, he probably would have still been alive today. And the pilot left him at the airstrip, which is like 5 km from one community and 3 km from the other, flew off into the sky, and my uncle, who was about 80% blind, sat there and then tried to walk, and he was obviously trying to see where the light was. We knew there was a fire in that area that came out in the inquiry, in the, what do you call it, when you have a death?
Coroner's inquest report, yeah.
Yep, and They didn't have the search for a couple of days. It wasn't until my cousin brother, Jeffrey, kept going up and saying, when's Dad being returned, that it was found out that he'd been delivered back out to the community about 3 days earlier, and he perished. And it was a it was a huge story for a while, and a very tragic story. And it is about how they have treated Aboriginal people with such disrespect and cut, you know, they've always done justice on the cheap for our people. So where there's cutting of money, that's what they did. And
that was your mother's brother.
And that was my mum's brother.
Yeah. Oh, I remember the story all too well.
Yeah.
You don't forget those sorts of stories.
And so we had, you know, the inquiry out there for one day, but they didn't particularly like it. So it's moved into Katherine. So we had to get a bus and move all of our family in there because the magistrate wasn't happy with staying out at a very remote community.
How long will it take a bus to go from community to Katherine?
It takes us about 7 hours from the community into Katherine because it's about a 10-hour trip from Darwin.
Quite a trek.
And then we had to find money to put ourselves up in the hotels and accommodation. And then we had to return there because the pilot took off to Florida and didn't come back or wasn't available to be on air for part of that inquest. So at the end,
as it does happen, convenient for the pilot to be overseas somewhere.
Yes. Well,
I'm a bit cynical.
They did get him the second time. I think the justice system said you need to be available. And he was in Hong Kong the second time and he had all the equipment and all the communications on the plane. He had his mobile phone. He could have rang to the council office or even to the health service to say, I've dropped an old man off there. And he didn't. And I don't think, you know, we were trying to get him that he should have been charged for things like there's a sort of like a very common law where you fail to assist someone to help them, survive. And I don't think anyone would do that to anybody, leaving them at a train station or a bus station or by themselves out in the middle of nowhere without providing some sort of help to see if someone will pick them up.
So. But in this case, we're not talking about an able-bodied person. We're talking about a quite elderly man. And with sight impaired as well, seriously sight impaired, and just coming out of hospital, somebody should have been jailed.
Yes, absolutely. We believe that was the case, and as it is with these inquiries, it's all about then doing some changing the administrative practices within the system, you know, and. This has always been our story, I think. There's very little real justice for our people when they die the most tragic of deaths. And one of the, so that's been our, you know, and our families are pretty closely linked in that way. So we have a lot of contact with our family back at home and when they come to Darwin. So a lot of my work, though, I guess, has been first in the public service and then moving out of that into, you know, being a consultant with another Aboriginal woman and then always clearly moving into that rights area where I had a big period of my life working and going to the United Nations. I think the last time I went was last year to New York, but I'd had a big 10-year gap in there. Sadly, what we do is we win so many of our rights, and we have done that, and you've been part of that, Tiger, and many other people before us and our elders that have struggled to get the conditions what we've got. And what we've seen, particularly in the Northern Territory, with the intervention being put in there at the territory where they can, because it's still a territory and the Australian government can take over the territory and its funding, which it did do. And we've seen, you know, we're now, that's been extended and we've had 5 or 6 years where that's been just hell on wheels for our people, where every part of their decision-making's been eroded. And we would challenge this whole issue about, you know, community consultation and engagement. The policies, the money has already been worked out, they're working out what they're doing, and their engagement and consultation is basically go out to tell the people what it is and that they might put a reference group together. And we're seeing that being extended in the territory, which is, and I just, it's good to see that the National Congress is starting, and I'm hoping that we will get some traction there. It'll take some while for them to probably get a voice again for people. But you know yourself, we've been smashed right across to have any real voice at an independent political and rights level in this country for a long time.
Hence that representation at the UN forums being vitally important. And I was quite cynical about that for a long time as a young radical, thinking, you know, it's a gummy shark over there. Australia's been documented by various reports as one of the most racist countries in the world, yet they can still introduce legislation where the Race Discrimination Act has to be suspended that affects First Nations people only. But it is essentially, it's vitally important that we do have that representation. People like yourself, in your time that you made those, was a part of delegations of our people going to the UN, it's vital that that happens. The Northern Territory intervention, wow. What a story. And now you've got stolen futures, although I think they call it stronger futures.
Yeah, but some might call it stranger futures.
Yes, you know. Yes. And that is the extension of this legislation. Now, Genocide Jenny, I think some people know her as Jenny Macklin, the minister. Some people also know her as the Protector Macklin. I prefer to refer to her as Genocide Jenny, because this legislation is manifests itself into cultural genocide for our mob. There's no question about that. What's been, you've said it's been, it hasn't been the best experience, but for your position now, the recent appointment of yourself into the job of CEO for a new peak body for Aboriginal children, youth and families. Strong Aboriginal Families Together. Safety. Has that come about because of... Why has it come about? Tell us why. Is the intervention... Has there been an increase in deaths, in hardship, in issues with our youth, our young people, our families, as a result of the intervention? Why this position now? It's a new position. Yeah? Tell us about it.
Well, it's all of the above that you mentioned, but the history lies, as you know, the intervention was implemented on the so-called claim that Aboriginal communities in the territory were a place for pedophiles to live and breed and be part of the community, and that, you know, it branded most Aboriginal men as pedophiles or abusers of children. And that's had an enormous scar on our men. But there was the report, the Little Children Are Sacred report, which Rex Weil and Pat Anderson had worked on. And those recommendations, very few of those recommendations had got up, and it took the NT government about 6 or 8 weeks to respond to that. In the meantime, the Howard government had moved in, because they had on their plans for a long time that they needed to actually get in to these communities. Part of it was to get resources to open it up to mining companies and every other private company and contractors and NGOs and any businesses that wanted to come into the territory, and particularly onto Aboriginal land. And so they were able, it still is, you know, you cannot believe in this country that they were able to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act. And I think it will be a shameful part of this history forever to do such an action. What has been sad that the Labor government, that many Aboriginal people have supported in this country, because they always felt that they had a better chance to recognise their rights and to have them truly participate in stuff, that this that government continued on with the intervention that the Howard government had put in. Yes, it's been rebranded and remarketed, and you know, it then became the Northern Territory Emergency Response to you know, closing the gap. And now we've got the policy of stronger futures. Look, there was an announcement last week and we put out a press release, and we really welcome the fact that this government has put in a 10-year commitment in funding. That's quite historical, and it needs to be that given that whole intergenerational poverty and disadvantage and marginalisation, the fact that our communities are, you know, wrapped with violence and hardship and poverty that should not be in this country. So there was another inquiry because they didn't take up the recommendations that came out of that little Children of Sacred report, and there was another inquiry because there were a number of deaths within the child protection system in the territory, and that inquiry thankfully did get a lot more traction and support from the Northern Territory government, and it was called Growing Them Strong Together, and it was Howard Barth, Professor Howard Barth, and Muriel Bamplett from the Victorian Aboriginal Child Care Agency. She was also a co-author of that report, and Rob, I have forgotten Rob's last name. I do know it. It's just gone out of my head. There was three of them, and they looked at the whole situation and they realised that there was no presence of any Aboriginal specific or agency looking at any service to do with family support, child protection, out-of-home care, what was traditionally known as ACCAS, because they were closed down. And that was one of the, you know, the part of the real key recommendations. I think it's number 2, 4, and there's a number of other recommendations that said, we need to have a peak organisation that will advocate, have policy, reshape in the Northern Territory how the child, youth and families safety and protection system should work. So we've been given this amazing opportunity because we've got a clean slate to see how we can develop our presence in this sector, given that 90% of the children in the Northern Territory are Aboriginal. So the whole department and this sector and all of the big NGOs that are in this sector exist and are part of that whole industry because of our children that are in the system. One of the things that came out of that report is we need to have some Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, not only the PEAK. So I was put on in July. I won that position to try and create that PEAK organisation from the ground up.
That position? That's the result of an inquiry into protection?
Yep.
Child protection, the state child protection system, they don't have a real good name or a good record, I suppose. It's not the name, but it's the record for good outcomes for mainstream kids, white fella kids, let alone black fella kids, across the country. So the Territory, no different, or what was the situation there?
The Territory, I think a lot of it had to do with that it sat within the health department, and so it was, you know, health, families and children. We know Indigenous health is massive in our country, so it was basically what I believe was the poor relations in that department. So they didn't get enough of the pie, so to speak. That was one of the recommendations that it came out. It was in such a need and at such a it was in such a state of disarray and broken that it now has its own department. That was one of the other recommendations. Now the Department of Children and Families. And so that was a key recommendation. So they've got 147 recommendations. All of them got taken up, which is an amazing and great thing that the NT government have actually said. They put the whole 147 recommendations in and said, let's implement them.
Have you experienced that before, where all recommendations from an inquiry or report are being implemented?
No, no. I could only say anecdotally. I wouldn't know, but I'd say it is a good outcome, yeah. And I'd imagine that that's the first time I've ever seen that. One of the things that they honoured was that there had to be a peak. That was very much in the AMPSAMP, which is our Aboriginal medical peak body up there. Was auspiced to actually set us up. So I was interviewed with the new CEO of this new department and AMPSANT, and I won the position of being the CEO to start this very exciting path for us in this journey. We've got our work cut out. The other thing that's quite historical, and again, got to, you know, tip my hat to the NT government. This is the first time I think that they have, I can't recall when they have funded the establishment of an Aboriginal community controlled organisation, at least for the last 25 years. I don't know of any other organisation. So this is a real positive thing that we've got happening. One of the things I've been tasked with, I'm the peak of nobody. There's no service agency. So I also have to establish the service arm, one in Darwin and one in Alice Springs. Although we also have the mandate to work out how to do it for the whole territory. And as we know that many of the Aboriginal people live outside of those two centres, and there are very few services for those communities. And part of the closing the gap and now even stronger futures, they've just picked 20 growth towns and all the funds have gone into there.
And they're starving people off country and off homeland and country and communities.
And it would be interesting to if there's any research to do with what has been the effect of not a cent going to a vast majority of people that haven't seen anything of this massive investment that the Australian government has made and the territory government. And that's our issue about this latest 10-year commitment, and it's a $430 odd million. I'm not sure how much of that is new monies, but we believe that they've missed the boat again. When you read it and unpackage it, it's heading for the government agencies again and into the big NGOs. Mm. Now, I know that
they're faring real well, aren't they, big NGOs?
NGOs, we're the new, it's an Indigenous industry. I mean, it's a funding frenzy for them.
Yes.
And without being, you know, totally disrespectful for them. And we know that there's been some great work, but you'd have to say that nothing has changed on the ground for our people.
Josie,
because
it gets taken in
administration.
It does. But a lot of it reminds me of the early days where the church groups came in with the Bible and all this preaching and stuff and taken blacks from being independent, strong, independent people, and putting us on missions and reserves, all church-controlled and run largely. Here we are. There doesn't seem to be much change. And where I'm looking, like I said earlier, I'm extremely cynical. I've been around too damn long.
Mm.
And I'm extremely cynical of these NGOs now, largely, again, church groups too, coming in and doing the same sort of stuff, really. And I think it's at the cost of our own self-determination, our own control in our own communities, of our own lives and our own situation. That's what the cost is here for us. And that's why I say it's the same as those early days of removal and stolen generations and stuff. What's a better way? How would you like to see things happen? What could these NGOs do better or in with government and us as community? How could it happen better?
Well, at the present, the present situation is the NGOs, those big NGOs, are winning money based on the fact that there are very few Aboriginal community-controlled organisations. The ones that really did survive the onslaught once that SIC disappeared and all of the work that's previous to that has been the legal services, because it's absolute need, and the health services. And congratulations to both of those, because they have lobbied hard and they've developed the best models. And particularly in the Northern Territory, they went for a tripartite forum with the Australian government, the NT government and themselves to actually say, we need to be at that table and divvying up where the money is and where the need is. So they've, and that's what we'd like to see in this whole area of child protection. We're calling for a tripartite forum rather than this scattergun approach where they're just hitting up money to any NGO. Oh, should we have a playgroup? Now, I'm not denigrating playgroups, because it's about you being really creative about how you can use what would seem a very small window of opportunity to address such a small part. But I'm saying to those NGOs, sadly, some of them are great and saying, we want to partner with you, but they're the ones receiving the big bucks, and then they pay an administration fee for us. I'm hoping that in the Northern Territory, we're wanting to say, we believe we can build the capacity of our people and do it differently. We want to model something, because I do believe in this sector, it is broken in every state. We're here as part of our service level agreement, where we're asked to look at every other state and territory to see what services, programs, what's been the development in child protection in this country, and see what might be comparable and what we can use for the territory.
I've got a caller on the line. Let's just take a call. Hello, how are you? You want to make a comment? Do you want to make a comment? You want to play me some music? Nah, sorry. Don't want to listen to that. Could be country music, if you want to play me something. Or Murray, you know, First Nations. 3892 0188 if you would like to make a call. Maybe that was somebody trying to give me a message there. Eh? Somebody out there giving me a message saying they're not too keen on the discussion. And
no,
play something
I think
decent,
so.
Something that's more appropriate for them. Let's see. We'll try again. Hello, how are you?
Not bad.
Turn that radio down, please, brother. It's reverberating and echoing and making all sorts of noises.
Righto. Yeah.
Who have I got? What's your name? What's your name?
Rochi.
Rochi, how are you?
Yeah. Listen, when you asked that lady a while back, some of the kids in Northern Territory had to wash their face and go to school. Did they ever get that petrol pump in that community?
A petrol pump in a community.
Yeah.
That could be one of 100.
If they washed their faces and went to school, they were going to put a petrol pump in that community. Did they ever do that?
All right. Don't know whether Josie knows that. There's probably 100 communities up there. This is Rochi, Josie.
Hi, Rochi. Look, I'm not sure of that story, but there are many, many conditions put on Aboriginal people and communities, and we got the latest in where if you don't send your child to school, there's 70% of your income management is going to be taken. And yet what we do know, that once they are taken into the system, many of our children still don't go to school because of their behavioural problems, and they're being moved, you know, maybe 1,500 k's. So Look, there could have been a petrol station put, a petrol pump put in. I'm not sure. I don't know that specific thing. I mean, the territory's so big and, you know, lots of little communities. So I'm sorry, Roachy, I couldn't answer that.
No worries. Anyway, Roachy, thanks for your call. If people want to make a call, it's 38920188. We'll take a break for a song and come back. 38920188, if you want to make a comment. My guest is Josie Crawshaw, CEO of Stronger Aboriginal Families. What's the T? Stronger Aboriginal Families Together. Together, that's what it is. Thanks, Victoria. Just, well, someone's got some support and help around here, Josie. You come with it all. Yeah, Josie Crawshaw from Darwin, Gurindji woman, joining me today. And now here's a person that you have an opportunity to hear directly from, somebody that's been affected, that is seeing family and community members affected by the Northern Territory intervention. It's a rare opportunity. We're sure we have people on here from time to time. So it's a rare opportunity where you can hear directly from an informed person, experienced person, and a person that has no reason to lie or distort the facts. So you sit back and let's hope you can take in some of what's being said. What you do with it from there is up to you. A song by Vic Sims, a First Nations man, La Perouse brother, Stranger in My Country. Welcome back. My guest, Josie Crawshaw, CEO of Stronger Aboriginal Families Together up in the Northern Territory. A recent appointment sometime last year. And Josie's in the studio live talking to us. Josie, we've spoke about broken systems and failings of the establishment for First Nations people right across the board. It impacted quite seriously on families and children of First Nations peoples. What do you see there with the impact and what needs to be done? But some of the stats and things like that has happened. Tell us a little bit about.
Well, in the Northern Territory, and I think it's true across Australia that the system is really being challenged for everybody. We're dealing with drugs in young families. We're dealing with young people that aren't being engaged with their children, whether they're black, white or brindle. The pressures on society are great. So it is very difficult. And a huge challenge, and we recognise that for the system. In the territory, though, as I said, we've got 90% of our kids are in the system, and that's because and a lot of those children get there through the notifications are about neglect, and our people are now paying the ultimate price of consecutive governments from the time that they've arrived, of actually impoverishing our communities. They haven't put the resources in. There's massive overcrowding of housing. It wouldn't matter where you put this anywhere in the world. It's no surprise. It's not rocket science that we've got dysfunctional families. If you're not educated, if you've never had schools in there, we don't have high schools. They're just getting that into the place in the last couple of years. So we are concerned that the whole word culture is neglect is so loaded culture, and it's culturally biased, that we want to change the dialogue around that. We want to change that in how they're actually removing our children because of that. For us, we're talking about how do we embed culture to build resilience? It is not sustainable for the department to remove children sometimes 1,500 k's away from their home and bringing them in. Sometimes they're bringing them in numbers of 35 and 78 out of Catherine in an eight-week period and removing them, you know, 300, 400 k's away from their family and their community. And what we're going to try and do is to develop a model and show them a best practice model, and we hope that both the federal government and the NT government will get on board with us to at least try and pilot a best practice model where we can look at how do we build and embed culture back into our people and build that resilience, keep children safe in what we know is an unsafe environment because of the poverty and lack of services in our community. And I think we can do that by really good old-fashioned social work of getting in and helping families. About our one of the most disturbing things for our kids is that we've got hundreds in the system that sadly, on the admission of the CE, and I pay respect for her to being so honest, that they can't tell you from their records or pull a report to say where those children are, where they've come from, who are they with, how are they going.
That's quite shocking.
It's, look, you know, anywhere else it would be an, you know, a massive royal commission, really. And what we're wanting to do is find those families, connect them back. Even the part of legislation Australia-wide is when the statutory authority through the court system or through the legislation allows them the powers to take a child, the one thing that they must do is have what they call a care plan. A case plan, care plan. What's their name? Where are they from? Who's their family? How long are they here? What treatment? We know that we've got over 30%, and we think it's a couple of hundred children that don't even have that plan, let alone a cultural care plan to connect them back to community. So we really have our work cut out. We know that the department has its work cut out. We believe we can assist them with that. And yes, we're just establishing. We're trying to get all our governance stuff in place first, because as you know, that's the one thing that they are so hard on with Aboriginal communities. It doesn't matter that the governance structure's in place for all the big NGOs, because we know there's been no runs on the board, but the governance structure's in place and they are supposed to be credible. So we really want to change that. Sadly for us also in the Territory, I think it was the Melbourne Age in the media, but Melbourne Age in particular, I think, referred to us in the Territory because of our being the youth suicide place in the world.
The highest rate.
We have the highest rate of youth suicide in the world, and we have to, and that's because of that whole disconnection. And we have to. They have to allow Aboriginal community-controlled organisations like ourselves and the medical services and the legal services to actually collaboratively look at how do we keep our children out of the justice system, how do we improve their health, how do we support families, how do we keep kids connected with their parents. And we know anywhere in the world that parents don't go out of their way to hurt and harm their
exactly.
children.
Josie, if we go back to the age-old thing, like I mentioned earlier, the system is creating options that aren't any better. They're worse, in fact, than what we're dealing with, than what we have before the system came in to make us dependent on the system, welfare recipients and what have you, to take our children from our own care and place them in government care. That's no better, whether they're white or black. They're not dealing with them. They're not taking them from an unsafe place and putting them from a place where there's so-called neglect and putting them in a better place. In a lot of cases, in most of the cases, that is not the case. They're going into worse places. There are more and more problems.
Yep.
And you've got a big job. It's a big challenge.
But
it's great that you've got the opportunity. It's fantastic.
I always wondered where my head was when I applied for this, and everyone says, congrats. Oh, God, you know, you're brave. But, you know, like I said, it's unique that we've been able to be funded for an Aboriginal community-controlled organisation. What we've learnt from our state visits, and even here in the... We've been here 2 days looking and meeting many organisations, and they're doing some fantastic work. And a lot of that is not recognised. They'll say sometimes they'll just even... see a mother that's been totally broken, doesn't know how to get her kids out of the system. They start working with her, and then one day she just walks in. She's bought herself a little outfit. She's just, you know, beautifully groomed. She's starting to actually stand proud and be told. And they go, what a win for us. That's what they consider a win. That doesn't get promoted out there. That they don't know how great our community organisations are and get recognised. We're not funded to the same level to actually do that marketing up. Sometimes an NGO in a big NGO or a government agency can do the most basic of things that you'd think, look, that's just core business and you just do it. But it's promoted as the most amazing practice. We know from what we've seen here that that the work that a lot of these REs are doing, other Aboriginal community-controlled organisations, they have been so willing to share their knowledge, and we really appreciate that, and that's going to really help us to go and shape what it is in the territory. We start our planning, well, we've been planning, but we have a specific planning session next week to try and shape now the model from what we've seen around the country.
What can we do? We do as individuals, as First Nations families, carers, individuals. What can we do and take some responsibility for what we've got the power
honestly,
to do? What's
that,
a couple of...
That's just a great, great way that we can lead into this. I think what it says about a child that will survive and to build resilience, you only need one person that they know is going to be there for them when they're in trouble and in time. Most time, all they want to do is be with their parents no matter what the situation
exactly.
Like. And most parents...
Regardless of what the situation is.
Yeah,
yes.
Most parents, 70% of the time, are on track and they're doing their stuff. And even though they're doing it hard, they're parenting. That 30% that they're off the radar on, that's when you need that one person to stand up and just say, I'm there for you. You know where you could come. Or they're keeping an eye out for those little ones that are babies that can't get out of there and crawl to a house and say, help me. So I'm saying to Aboriginal people, we need, and it is a hard job, but we need people to take out, to keep them home, keep them safe, develop with us ways for that 30% of the time. We got some safe places for those kids to be.
You're basically saying we need to go back to our old values and old customs and have a village look after a child. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
It's as simple as that.
That's exactly what I'm saying, and that's what we want to do at home. Go out, particularly look at the outstations and stuff where there's some resources out there. Work with the community. Say, what happens when we know that that's the case? Let's get some funding in, whether it's the ILC, through the land councils, through the different government agencies, any of these philanthropic organisations. We have a catastrophe on our hands. We have a total breakdown where we have got our children now with no future, and we've got, the highest suicide.
And again, Josie, it's not just us as First Nations people. The dominant culture, dominant society are in a worse position, I believe, because they don't realise what they don't have. They don't have the cultural values and background and the DNA that we have embedded in our culture, embedded in our DNA. The dominant culture is worse off than us. And if we can take these steps and have a community looking after a child, then Whitefellas going to follow along. We're going to show the way.
And, you know, that's what hasn't been here. I think there is this unshakable belief in this country by most non-Indigenous people that we need help and intervention.
We can do it.
At every level.
Yeah.
And it is not true. We know that we can look after and make the right decisions with the support to get back on track. As I said, you can't, this is no surprise that our communities are in the state they are. If you actually de-advantage them, to this extent, it was always going to end there.
The history is across the world with colonised communities, colonised yep. people is across the world. Josie, we're getting close to news time. There you go, an hour's gone.
Wow.
Okay, and you were worried about filling an hour? As if. You and me at a microphone? Now, look, it's great having yes. you here. It's fantastic. You've got a fantastic opportunity. It's a big challenge, but you've got a fantastic opportunity. Is there anything you want to say in the last 30 seconds we've got?
I guess the main thing I want to do is thank our board. It was an interim board to actually help me and me help them to work out what we're going to do. We'll be meeting next week. They've been fantastic. They come from every part of the territory. And yes, we've got our work cut out, but what an exciting and great path we're on, where we've got a clean slate and we've just got to get governments and that to have the confidence that we will be able to do this.
Thanks for joining us today. Good luck with it. And wherever First Nations media can be utilised, you know how to do that.